Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to the Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, this is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. As a general rule, when I prepare this weekly program, I gather information from news sources and select those items which I feel are appropriate for a program that's only heard once a week. After I choose the items and record three sections of the program, I'll wait until practically the last moment and record the introduction to ensure that it serves as an introduction to what follows. However, this week is totally different. After I had prepared the program, Arabs living in Jerusalem and Lod, which is near Israel's international airport, began rioting and missiles were fired from Gaza into Israel. A number of people were injured and a number were killed. My own children, who live near the airport, spent the night in shelters. They could hear the sounds of rockets and explosions. At this moment, now while I'm broadcasting, is for all intents and purposes at war. And the enemy is not one that wishes to conquer Israel, for it knows that that is impossible. The enemy, the Palestinian terror groups, and those who support them have only one goal, and that is to kill Jews. That is the nature of our enemy. It's something that the world, including the United States and the United Nations, simply does not understand or chooses not to understand. The Palestinians could have established a state in 1948, in 1967, and in 1993. But establishment of a state was never their goal. Their goal was and is to destroy the Jewish state and to kill Jews. That sounds simplistic, but it is the truth. It is a truth that we have to live with and to deal with. The Gaza Strip is a cancer right next to Israel's population heartland, and it has to be dealt with. At the moment, we do not have a stable government, which may come into being within a week. But in the meantime, those in charge have to deal with the deadly reality that is unique to Israel. I'm sorry that this is the truth, but we have to live with it. I'll be back after the break.
The return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel was prophesied in the Bible thousands of years ago and is coming true today. Shalom. Join me, Josh Wander, on Israel Unplugged. Listen in as we delve into the spiritual and physical aspects of the Jewish return to Zion. We'll discuss the biblically mandated, historic, and of course practical understandings of this incredible transition from exile to redemption. That's Israel Unplugged, every Monday on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to say a few words about the newest form of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is rather unique in the fact that it can take on all kinds of new forms and shapes depending upon who's doing the accusing. The latest word to use against Israel is Israel is being accused of the crimes of apartheid. That's something that we know from the administration in South Africa. From the period right about the time of the Second World War until late in the 20th century, was a new word. It's a word that comes from the Afrikaans language. At any rate, everybody knows what apartheid is when they hear the word. It's been some kind of action taken opposed to human rights. I guess the best way to describe it. And now there is a Human Rights Watch, which gives out a report. While Israel is accused of committing the crime of apartheid in a Human Rights Watch report, it's imperative that the international community comprehends the extent of the accusations and how a metric, a singular standard, is used solely and uniquely against the State of Israel. In reality, it is not that difficult to expose the cynicism of this report. All one needs to do is to prove that the accusations are not only baseless, but also unheard of, literally, since South Africa. International law professor Eugene Kantorovich rightly explains that invoking the crime of apartheid to criticize Israel's policies is a form of classic anti-Semitic rhetoric, and accuses Jews, uniquely among peoples of the world, of the most heinous crimes, while also judging the Jewish state by a metric not applied to any other country. In fact, the legal standard for labeling a government an apartheid regime is set so high that no country since South Africa has ever received this distinction. Despite massive systematic oppression of racial and ethnic minorities in other parts and in many parts of the world, the very essence of apartheid was the physical separation of people based on a legislated racial hierarchy in South Africa under the Reservation of Separate Amenities Act of 1953. Grounds could be reserved for a particular race, creating separate schools and beaches and pools and parks. Needless to say, there's no such law or anything like that law in Israel. Israel guarantees everyone equal treatment before the law and has proved its democratic nature in all possible fields, from parliamentarians in the Knesset, where there are some who are Arabs and Muslims, free speech, judges residing on the Supreme Court. There are Arab judges on Israel's Supreme Court, and there are Arab players on Israel's national soccer team. You name it, Israel has proven to be as diverse as they come. As a blunt example that says it all, one of the former Israeli presidents was sentenced for rape allegations to 7 years in prison, and the one who made this judgment was an Arab judge. Now, why does this Human Rights Watch come out with this kind of report? Perhaps it is not merely meant to exert pressure on the international community so that on its turn it will exert pressure on Israel to give in to Palestinian demands, but it's also meant more accurately to delegitimize the State of Israel entirely. And for that to happen, the Human Rights Watch, which is a very interesting name, the Human Rights Watch has decided to demonize the State of Israel by calling it an apartheid state, because what else should be done to an apartheid regime other than to dismantle it and replace it? In reality, Human Rights Watch is well aware of the very complicated situation in which Israel finds itself. Even as I'm broadcasting, making this broadcast today, there are riots here in Jerusalem by the members of the Arab community. On the one hand, Israel is in a very odd situation, unusual. On one hand, Israel is considered to be the occupying power and expected to administer military law per the Fourth Geneva Convention. And on the other hand, Israel is expected to abide by the Oslo Interim Agreement. Yet Human Rights Watch does not hesitate to admit all of that in order to falsely label Israel an apartheid regime, because in essence, the authors of the report want to achieve political aims as opposed to what they pretend to be legal aims. In fact, The Human Rights Report says the following, and I quote, "Israelis are granted superior status under laws compared to the Palestinians living in the same territory when it comes to civil rights, access to land, and freedom to move," unquote. But conveniently, this report omits to explain that the Israelis as well as the Palestinians had mutually agreed to this arrangement as part of the internationally recognized Oslo Accords. Since the Oslo Accords, for example, the area known as the West Bank, and we call Judea and Samaria, has been split into three areas, A, B, and C. In area A and B, the Palestinian Authority has full civil rights, meaning building permits fall solely under the Palestinian Authority's authority, while in the area C, it is Israel that retains that authority. This is why the Palestinian population in areas A and B fall under a different set of laws than the Israeli civilians in Area C. Having said that, if the Human Rights Watch suggests one civil law for all, it would mean a de facto annexation. As for freedom of movement, the restrictions are solely in place out of security considerations and not based on any racial discrimination. It would be ludicrous to claim otherwise, since 20% of Israel's population is in fact Arab and are free to move anywhere they please and even to be members of the Knesset. And to completely expose the hollowness of these accusations of apartheid, Jews and Arabs alike were able to visit the same restaurants and shop in Area C, especially like or exactly like anywhere in Israel. Moreover, the Human Rights Watch uses Israel's basic law of the nation-state law to strengthen the apartheid accusations. Yet by invoking the nation-state law, it is, on the contrary, proving once again that the actual aim is to delegitimize and ultimately abolish the state of Israel entirely. Otherwise, why mention it? Do the Palestinians in the territories obtain more rights if Israel's nation-state law is removed? The nation-state law was passed as Israel's sole law that guarantees the Jewish character of the state of Israel. That's what it's all about. The Hebrew language, the anthem, and the flag are subsequently reinforced by law, which enact the purpose of the law is the establishment of a Jewish state. Nevertheless, it is important to highlight that this law does not abolish nor does it contradict any of the existing basic laws ensuring minority rights and equality before the law. Arabs still reside on Israel's Supreme Court, obtain seats in the Knesset, study at Israel's universities, exercise any profession they like, and pray at the numerous mosques all over the state of Israel. These are the facts. Although it's widely considered among moderate voices that the Human Rights Watch has taken a leap into the unknown with a report that is slanderous at best, it's wrong to assume that the truth will prevail. Human Rights Watch knows all too well that it has a strong backing, as its authors have watched the UN and its multiple bodies single out Israel systematically since the UN came into existence for targeting. Therefore, refuting the Human Rights Report, which, by the way, is more than 200 pages long, you have to come forward with the truth. It won't suffice. There's a whole system in place on an international platform to delegitimize the state of Israel by standards applied solely to Israel. And that's exactly what this situation is. Human Rights Watch put out a report, more than 200 pages, accusing Israel of apartheid. That's the bottom line. And I felt it's really important to mention where the truth lies. Although there are people who simply do not wish to see the truth. They simply want to accuse Israel of being an apartheid state. And just the use of the word apartheid is so heinous that just saying it about Israel makes Israel look bad, and it really is unfair. So here we are, all these years after the Second World War, and Israel has established a state for the Jews, and it's being accused of the same kinds of things that were used against the Jews until the Jewish state came into being. And I just wanted to go on the record with that this week. So, having said that, I shall be back after the break.
Hi everyone, this is Andrea Simintow from Jerusalem, inviting you to drop everything and join me on my show, Pull Up a Chair. We'll visit this week's quirky stories, meet fabulous guests, and discover my Israel. Together we'll laugh, shout, and explain the topics that make us say, hey, we've got to talk about that. So get comfortable and pull up a chair with me, Andrea Simintow, every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Back to Jay Shapiro. We are only 4 months into the Biden administration, and there are some troubling signs, as I can see it, about what our relationship is going to be with this administration. First of all, it's known that the Americans are trying to get back into the nuclear deal with Iran, something which was not good for Israel, and which our prime minister actually went and spoke before the American Congress against it several years ago. So that's one thing, but there are other signs that are a little bit worrying. Because Joe Biden seems to care deeply about combating hate. Unless, of course, it's directed at the targets of the world's oldest hatred. We all expected the president to speak about hate in America during his first address to a joint session of Congress. And he indeed did. He talked about the systematic racism and white supremacy. He mentioned attacks upon blacks, against Native Americans, and against women. He celebrated a hate crimes act to protect Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. Several weeks ago, in fact, provided Biden with an additional reason to discuss hate in America. The incidents were 4 different synagogues and 3 vehicles were vandalized in a Jewish neighborhood in the Bronx. All were damaged in precisely the same way, smashed windows and hate writing on the walls. Every student of the Holocaust knows that the Nazis' first wholesale violent attack on Jewish property was Kristallnacht, the so-called Night of Broken Glass. And seeing it replicated in microcosm on the streets of New York traumatized the Jewish community and gave Biden the opportunity to calm things down regarding the Jewish community's concern, and Biden could have come up with healing words. He passed. He didn't do so. President Biden spoke about the viciousness of the hate crimes over the past year, never mentioned the community that is, according to the FBI, overwhelmingly the most frequent victim. Given the small Jewish population of the United States, which is roughly 2% of Americans, a Jew is several times more likely to be the target of a hate crime than all of those who earned Biden's mention. Could we imagine that the President of the United States would have said nothing if it had instead been 4 black churches or 4 mosques that were vandalized? Of course not. It would have been a leading element of his address, the centerpiece of his section on fighting bigotry. For Biden to spend so much time talking about racism and hate in America and to rattle off a long list of targeted groups, yet omit entirely the targets of multiple hate crimes carried out within the previous week, I believe sends its own message. Jews don't qualify as a targeted group, according to President Biden. Instead, Biden called for the passage of a bill called the Equality Act that would give state sanction to anti-Semitism. It provides a potent weapon to be used against anyone who dares hold a Jewish wedding with a mechitza, a divider between men and women, in accordance with thousands of years of Jewish observance. What do I mean by this? Well, for Asians, Biden called for passage of a new hate crime act for the more frequent Jewish victims of precisely the same random violent assaults. He called to make their religious practices a violation of American statutes and to declare our Bible a bigoted document. This is not entirely new. We do not have to wait for a joint session of Congress to wonder whether Jewish concerns were being ignored by this new administration. One Biden appointee after another have a track record of hostility toward the Jewish state and the Jewish people. I'll give you some examples. Biden placed Maher Bitar, whose animosity against the world's only Jewish state has been placed in charge of intelligence on the National Security Council. As USAID administrator, he selected Samantha Power, the former UN ambassador who in 2016 helped draft the ridiculously anti-historical and obviously hateful UN Security Council Resolution 2334, which declared the site of the Jewish temple, David City, the Mount of Olives, Judea and Samaria, to be occupied Arab land. And as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Israeli and Palestinian Affairs at the State Department, he picked someone named Hedy Amer, A-M-R, who responded to the neutralization of a notorious Hamas terrorist by decrying Israel's brutal murders of innocents and implying that both Israelis and Americans deserve to be targeted in return. And this is by no means an exhaustive list of Biden appointees with similar records and attitudes. That is what is so frightening about this new administration. Also, within the past several weeks, dozens of rockets from Hamas terrorists have targeted Israeli towns attempting to murder men, women, and children indiscriminately for the crime of being a Jew trying to live on the Jews' holy land. Biden claimed that, and I quote, our intelligence agencies, unquote, not only regard white supremacy biased thoughts as terrorism, but the most lethal terrorist threat today. The most frequent targets of terrorist threats would, of course, beg to disagree. That's us. But according to the President Biden, Jews aren't a targeted group after all. So we have a very serious problem that in this major talk and his major actions against bias, and by the way, which are to be praised. Obviously, any president who speaks out against bias is obviously doing the right thing. However, he actually mentions those he feels are being attacked and must be protected. That's Native Americans, Blacks, women, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, for example, but no mention of the Jews. And that is, I hope, something that will be changed or overcome in his future talks. However, so far the signs of the Biden administration's attitude toward anti-Semitism, including the people he has appointed to some very sensitive positions, are really not very good. They are not good signs, and it's something that we have to keep our eye upon. I generally do not talk about American policy. I have a program once a week, which is broadcast out of Israel. And there are all kinds of experts on foreign affairs who speak about things that the American administration is doing or not doing. And the only thing I really look at is how things affect the Jews. And as I said, to sum up what I said in the last few minutes, the signs are not encouraging, because although it is good that the American president has come out against bias, really good, however, it is just the people who are being the suffering by bias. He neglected to mention the historically suffering people. Jews have been suffering bias for at least 2,000 years since they lost their homeland. And we don't have to go through the detailed minutiae of Jewish history. But to have the American president speak out against bias, which is a good thing, but not include the Jews, is something that does not bode well for the Jewish people. Or I should put it this way, doesn't bode well for the representative of the Jewish people, and that is the state of Israel. So it's something we have to keep our eye upon. And by the way, I don't really like to dwell on this. As I said, anti-Semitism has been around too long for a short program like mine to discuss. But we have to keep our eye on things that are happening just to get an idea of what could be happening in the near future. And so far, the signals from the Biden administration is that anti-Semitism is no longer considered to be what we know it to be, which is the measles of humanity. And I really don't want to speak any more about this, so I'll sign off with that. And then the last portion of my program, I'll devote to something much lighter. And you can find a lot of things lighter than anti-Semitism. I'll be back after the break.
Are you interested in transforming your life, drawing closer to the Creator, and uncovering the deeper meanings and hidden treasures in the Hebrew Bible?
Then join me, Rav Yitzhak Michelson.
And me, William Hall.
On The Science of Kabbalah, where we are seeking to narrow the gap between what we understand of our physical and spiritual worlds. So make sure to tune in every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Hello, I am Walter Bingham. If you want to hear the news behind the news and the true perspective on world affairs, then the Walter Bingham File is the program for you. We bring you interviews with the movers and shakers, political commentaries, and on-the-spot reports of events as they happen. All here every Tuesday, 4 p.m. Israel time, 9 a.m. Eastern time. And it's all archived on our website. Make it a date.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. As a policy on this program, I talk about current events. I try to keep the listeners updated, but I don't talk about ongoing current events. By that I mean ongoing current events means something that could change from one day to the next. But something happened this week, and I want to talk a little bit about it because it's important. On Monday was Jerusalem Day, and I went downtown to see the dancing and the crowds. Now, as a general rule, every year, the crowds end the day by going to the Old City, to the Western Wall, and celebrating there. This year, they were prevented because the Arabs were rioting in the Old City. At the same time, the Hamas, or whoever it is in the Gaza Strip, was firing rockets in the direction of Jerusalem, among other places, and we had to go home and make sure that our shelters were ready for us, something which has not happened in quite a while. So I want to make a few comments about that. The problem is that the violence has erupted again. Now, this time it's on the Temple Mount. There's a place there called the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and there's no clear cause and effect for it. Hamas, the terror organization, which is interested in situations spiraling out of control, and they'd like to have the Jews' presence removed from the Temple Mount, including the presence of Jewish police. But that obviously is not going to happen. Israel's dilemma right now is to find the key to defusing the situation, to find it cause or that actor that could change the dynamic. It's just getting out of control this way. So it's obviously not going to be easy. Sometimes in the past, when violence flared on the Temple Mount, Jordan, with his historical role as a custodian of non-Jewish holy sites in Jerusalem, could be asked to step in and help calm down the situation. However, today, relations between Jerusalem and the King Abdullah are at a low ebb with plenty of internal problems of his own. The king has to keep his crown on his head, not be assassinated. It's unlikely that he'll do anything extra to help Israel extract itself from a difficult situation. Unless, of course, the violence gets out of hand, Hamas gains the upper hand, and Abdullah feels that Hamas's control of the West Bank could spread to his kingdom and threaten him. Or unless the United States nudges Jordan into playing a constructive role in tamping down the tension. Meanwhile, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas also has no interest to serve as a calming influence. If anything, the opposite is true. A few days ago, there was a great deal of anger on the Palestinian street toward Abbas because of his decision to cancel the Palestinian Authority elections. These elections, by the way, are so far 11 years overdue. But now they can say that the Israeli police are desecrating Al-Aqsa. The postponement of the elections is very much yesterday's news. Abbas is now in a pitch competition with Hamas of who can show the most support for these Jerusalem Arabs. Now, I assume that Washington would like to help calm things down, but Washington's influence is limited. Instead, over the last number of days, Washington has fallen back on old patterns, issuing sort of even-handed statements, calling on both sides to show restraint, and calling on both sides to work to calm down the situation. And the American statements pretty much group Palestinian terrorism with Jewish violence, which is really nothing compared to the Arab violence. The State Department, the U.S. State Department, issued a statement about the violence, and then a couple of days later, the National Security Advisor, a guy named Jake Sullivan, called on Israeli counterpart, a fellow named Meir Ben-Shabbat, and released a readout of the conversation, which said that he expressed Washington's serious concern about the situation in Jerusalem. Now, Ben-Shabbat, the Israeli representative, according to media reports, pushed back against international intervention, and he said this only serves the inciters of the violence because it gives them what they're looking for, international condemnation of Israel and emergency meetings at the UN. Israel also cannot now look at its new Arab partners in the Gulf to step in and try to calm down the situation. Why not? Because the violence is happening at one of the holiest sites in Islam during the holiest month, the month of Ramadan, and on one of Israel's holiest days. This is something that infuriates Muslims all over the world, and if they are not influenced on their own, there are those like Turkish President Erdogan who incite them to ensure they'll be infuriated. The United Arab Emirates, who had made a peace deal with Israel, regardless how much it prizes its new relation with Israel, is not going to swim against this angry Muslim stream. One unique direction Israel may presently look at is to help de-escalate the situation is a gentleman named Mansour Abbas, who is the head of an Arab party in the Knesset called Ra'am, which has emerged as the coalition kingmaker because our prime minister, Netanyahu, has returned a mandate to form a new government, and he's given it to the head of another party called, the party is called Yesh Atid. The head of the party is Yair Lapid. And Yair Lapid has gotten together with Naftali Bennett, who's the head of the Yamina party. And they're in talks with Abbas to get him to support the government. In other words, they're turning to the head of the Arab party in the Knesset to help them support a government. Even if they don't join the government, they'll support it from the outside or even perhaps join it. So this could be the time for someone to take Abbas aside and tell him to work with the police to calm down the situation. The situation is not good for Israel. And it's not good for Abbas, the head of a small Arab party in Israel's Knesset, because if it continues and the Israeli Arabs support or even take part in this uprising, it would erode the legitimacy of the Arab parties. These parties, like Ram, have won large swaths of the Israeli public to either be full or silent partners in the government. In other words, even after all these years, Israel is in the 72nd day of its existence. We have an Arab party which is respected, could either become part of the government or support the government from the outside. On the other hand, the head of the Arab party is a tough situation because he's supposed to apparently the Arabs will want him to support what's happening on the Temple Mount. So in this situation, which is extremely tense, this could be a moment for Abbas, the head of the Arab party, to use his connections with the government and work with it and the police to defuse the situation, perhaps by bringing his own supporters to Al-Aqsa to pray, having worked out an arrangement with the police beforehand. He could then say that he won a police agreement to partially withdraw and enable massive prayers at the site. It's an extremely delicate situation. Now, the bottom line is that Abbas is the leader of one small Arab party, yet he has emerged as someone who could very well determine who will be Israel's prime minister. In other words, think about it for a moment. Who will be the prime minister of the Jewish state will depend upon whom this Arab party supports. So the situation has to be diffused, the situation in Jerusalem, but Arab voices calling for calm and trying to tamp down the tension rather than fanning the flames would be especially welcome in a time like this. So this Abbas, the head of a small Arab party in the Knesset, is essentially uniquely situated to calm down the situation if he so desires. Then, so if he doesn't decide to help calm down the situation, then those of the Jewish parties, like the head of Yesh Atid, Yair Lapid, and the head of Yamima, Naftali Bennett, might think twice about courting him politically. and he might be compelled to take a second look and decide what to do. So the fact that there is a small Arab party that can decide what the next Israeli government will look like, at the same time there is Arab rioting in Jerusalem and there is firing of rockets from the Gaza Strip into Israel, including toward Jerusalem, this is an extremely tense situation. I'm recording this program on Tuesday for broadcast on Thursday. So it's pretty rough. It's hard to know what's going to mean. As a general rule, as I said, I don't talk about really current situations. So it could well be that the situation will change in the next couple of hours. Even. We'll have to wait and see. Thanks again for listening. Jay Shapiro signing off.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Jake in Anchorage, Alaska, and I love listening to all the super interesting interviews and up-to-date information on what's happening in Israel.
Hello, this is Anna King, originally from London, now living in Israel. And what can I say? Israel News Talk Radio is my cup of tea.
My name is Bhaskar. I'm from India, and I love listening because you get to know the truth and wonderful voices from this lovely country.
Mom! Okay, wait a minute.
Hi, this is Chava Dax, and I'm calling for the rolling hills of Maale Adumim, just north of Jerusalem. I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio to get all the latest news and commentary and to keep me up to date every day.
This is Sarah Dax from Maale Adumim, and I'm 12. I wish Israel News Talk Radio was boring so my mom wouldn't listen to it all the time. Mom!
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.